Chapter 42. There are several good protections against temptations, but the surest is cowardice. Pudd'nhead Wilson's New Calendar. Names are not always what they seem. The common Welsh name Chxwep is pronounced Jackson. Pudd'nhead Wilson's New Calendar. Friday, December 13th. Sailed, at 3 p.m., in the Mareroa. Summer season day good ship life has nothing better. Monday. 3 days of paradise. Warm and sunny and smooth. The sea luminous Mediterranean blue. One lolls in a long chair all day under deck awnings, and reads and smokes, in measureless content. One does not read prose at such a time, but poetry. I have been reading the poems of Mrs. Julia A. Moore, again, and I find in them the same grace and melody that attracted me, when they were first published 20 years ago, and have held me in happy bonds ever since. The sentimental songbook has long been out of print, and has been forgotten by the world in general, but not by me. I carry it with me always, it and Goldsmith's Deathless Story. Indeed, it has the same deep charm for me that the Vicar of Wakefield has, and I find in it the same subtle touch, the touch that makes an intentionally humorous episode pathetic, and an intentionally pathetic one funny. In her time Mrs. Moore was called the Sweet Singer of Michigan, and was best known by that name. I have read her book through twice today, with the purpose of determining which of her pieces has most merit, and I am persuaded that for wide grasp and sustained power, William Upson may claim first place. William Upson. Heir he Major's only son. Come all good people far and near, oh, come and see what you can hear, it's of a young man true and brave, that is now sleeping in his grave. Now, William Upson was his name, if it's not that, it's all the same he did enlist in a cruel strife, and it caused him to lose his life. He was Perry Upson's eldest son, his father loved his noble son, this son was 19 years of age, when first in the rebellion he engaged. His father said, that he might go, but his dear mother she said no, oh, stay at home, dear Billy, she said, but she could not turn his head. He went to Nashville, in Tennessee, there his kind friends he could not see, he died among strangers, so far away, they did not know where his body lay. He was taken sick, and lived 4 weeks, and oh, how his parents weep, but now they must in sorrow mourn, for Billy has gone to his heavenly home. Oh, if his mother could have seen her son, for she loved him, her darling son. If she could hear his dying prayer, it would ease her heart till she met him there. How it would relieve his mother's heart, to see her son from this world depart, and hear his noble words of love, as he left this world for that above. Now it will relieve his mother's heart, for her son is laid in our graveyard. For now she knows, that his grave is near, she will not shed so many tears. Although she knows, not that it was her son, for his coffin could not be opened, it might be someone in his place, for she could not see his noble face. December, 17. Reached Sydney. December, 19. In the train. Fellow of 30 with 4 valises, a slim creature, with teeth which made his mouth look like a neglected churchyard. He had solidified hair solidified with pomatum, it was all one shell. He smoked the most extraordinary cigarettes made of some kind of manure, apparently. These and his hair made him smell like the very nation. He had a low-cut vest on, which exposed a deal of frayed and broken and unclean shirt front. Showy studs, of imitation gold they had made black discs on the linen. Oversized sleeve buttons of imitation gold, the copper base showing through. Ponderous watch chain of imitation gold. I judge that he couldn't tell the time by it, for he asked Smythe what time it was, once. He wore a coat which had been gay when it was young, 5 o'clock tea trousers of a light tint, and marvelously soiled, yellow mustache with a dashing upward whirl at the ends, foxy shoes, imitation patent leather. He was a novelty and imitation dude. He would have been a real one, if he could have afforded it. But he was satisfied with himself. You could see it in his expression, and in all his attitudes and movements. He was living in a new dreamland, where all his squalid shams were genuine, and himself a sincerity. It disarmed criticism, it mollified spite, to see him so enjoy his imitation languors, and arts, and airs, and his studied daintinesses of gesture and misbegotten refinements. It was plain to me that he was imagining himself the Prince of Wales, and was doing everything the way he thought the Prince would do it. For bringing his four valises aboard, and stowing them in the nettings, he gave his porter 4 cents, and lightly apologized for the smallness of the gratuity just with the condescendingest little royal air in the world. He stretched himself out on the front seat, and rested his pomatum cake on the middle arm, and stuck his feet out of the window, and began to pose as the prince, and work his dreams and languors for exhibition. And he would indolently watch the blue films curling up from his cigarette, and inhale the stench, and look so grateful, and would flip the ash away with the daintiest gesture, unintentionally displaying his brass ring in the most intentional way. Why, it was as good as being in Marlborough House itself to see him do it so like. There was other scenery in the trip. That of the Hawkesbury River, in the National Park region, fine, extraordinarily fine, with spacious views of stream and lake imposingly framed in woody hills, and every now and then the noblest groupings of mountains, and the most enchanting rearrangements of the water effects. Further along, green flats, thinly covered with gum forests, with here and there the huts and cabins of small farmers engaged in raising children. Still further along, arid stretches, lifeless and melancholy. Then Newcastle, a rushing town, capital of the rich coal regions. Approaching Scone, white farming and grazing levels, with pretty frequent glimpses of a troublesome plant, a particularly devilish little prickly pear, daily damned in the orisons of the agriculturist, imported by a lady of sentiment, and contributed gratis to the colony. Blazing hot, all day. December 20. Back to Sydney. Blazing hot again. From the newspaper, and from the map, I have made a collection of curious names of Australasian towns, with the idea of making a poem out of them. Tumate Kimura Willumba Boral Ballarat Milengajari Murundi Wagga Wagga Wailong Murumba Jigumaru Wulloway Wangari Wanilla Wuro Kapio Yankalilla Yaranyaka Yakamarundi Kawaka Kumaru Toranga Jilong Tongariro Kikarawaka Tipu Uhiparawat Pinga Gilwa Muno Paranin Kita Mipanga Kapunda Karinga Panola Nangwari Kongarong Kamam Kaliwardi Kilanula Narakurt Miluwardi Binam Wallaru Wariga Mandura Oraki Ranjara Riri Tiwamu Taranaki Tawumba Gundawindi Jarildari Wangaro Awalongam Wilumilu Bambolakal Gardi Bandigo Kanambal Kudamundrawal Gulga Midagong Jambaru Kondaparinga Kuitpoting Kilo Ikaparinga Talunga Yatalaparawuramuru Wangari Wulandunga Bularu Pernati Paramata Terum Narandara Daniliquan Kaakawa. It may be best to build the poem now, and make the weather help, a sweltering day in Australia. To be read soft and low, with the lights turned down. The bambola faints in the hot boral tree, where fierce Milengajari smothering fires far from the breezes of Coolgardie burn ghastly, and blue as the day expires. And Murriwillumba complaineth in song for the garlanded bowers of Willumilu, and the Ballarat fly and the lone Wollongong they dream of the gardens of Jambaru. The Wallaby sighs for the Murrumbidgee, for the velvety sod of the Munnopara, where the waters of healing from Miluwardi flow dim in the gloaming by Yaranyaka. The Kapio sorrows for lost Wulloway, and sigheth in secret for Murrumbidgee. The Wanjaru Wombat lamenteth the day that made a man exile from Jarildari. The Tiwamu Tumut from Wariga's glade, the Nankita swallow, the Wallaroo swan, they long for the peace of the Tameru shade and thy balmy soft airs, O sweet Mittagong. The Karinga buffalo pants in the sun, the Kondaparinga lies gaping for breath, the Kongarong Kamom to the shadow has won, but the Gumaru sinks in the slumber of death. In the weltering hell of the Mururu plain the Yatala Wangari withers and dies, and the Wuro Wanilla, demented with pain, to the Wolgulga woodlands despairingly flies. Sweet Nanguaries desolate, Canamble wails, Unting Kilo Kuido in sables is dressed, for the Wamjirai winds fall asleep in the sails, and the Buluru life breeze is dead in the west. Mpongo, Kapunda, O slumber no more Yankalila, Parawura, be warned there's death in the air. Kilamula, wherefore shall the prayer of Panola be scorned? Kudamundra, Anteki, and Wakatipu, Toowoomba, Kikaur are lost from Onkaparinga to Faramaru all burn in this hell's holocaust. Paramatta and Binam are gone to their rest in the vale of Tapanitarum. Kaakawa, Daniliquin, all that was best in the earth, are but graves and a tomb. Narandara mourns, Cameron answers not when the roll of the scathless we cry Tongariro, Gundawindi, Woolandunga, the spot is mute, and forlorn where ye lie. Those are good words for poetry. Among the best I have ever seen. There are 81 in the list. I did not need them all, but I have knocked down 66 of them, which is a good bag, it seems to me, for a person not in the business. Perhaps a poet laureate could do better, but a poet laureate gets wages, and that is different. When I write poetry I do not get any wages, often I lose money by it. The best word in that list, and the most musical and gurgly, is Willumaloo. It is a place near Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.